There is only one thing that you can control in your life. That's your thoughts. You can choose to be happy or you can choose to be miserable. It's just that simple. Join me for the next hour on Law of Attraction Talk Radio, where I hope to inspire you to make the conscious decision to be happy. For that is the exact place where you need to be to create your own magnificent reality. Let us begin. Now. Well, welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from beautiful Southern California, and I'm grateful that you're here tonight because we have a very, very special show for you. Today is September 11th, 2011. Exactly 10 years ago, Major Contrast was introduced to us, and not only to us, but to the entire world. Our lives changed exactly on September 11th, 2001. And through that contrast, today we are experiencing a global desire for worldwide peace. Thank goodness. As we talked last week, that contrast is what allows us to expand. And even though it was devastating for us to experience what happened in New York, today we are much better because of that experience. So it is with that I am fortunate to introduce you again to Dr. Sharini Pillay, who's going to be talking to us about how to create through the ABCs of the Law of Attraction. And you well remember Dr. Pillay as the medical doctor, psychiatrist, and person from the Harvard Medical School, the person who's done all of the brain imagery studies that show beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Law of Attraction is real and how it works in the brain. So we're going to be looking forward to that today, and I'm always thrilled to have Dr. Pillay with us. And we also have another special treat. Because it's 9/11, I thought it would be worth our while to really start being inspired about becoming peaceful from within. And Mr. Bob Kelly sent me this phenomenal video from the Words of Peace Global website. And I urge everyone to go there because you are going to really become inspired to let the peace begin within and then ripple out. So today we have a special video audio presentation clip, and it's a lecture from, and I hope I say this right, Prem Rawat, who gave us the topic of Reign of Peace. And I think it's so appropriate for us to hear today, and I'm delighted to be able to bring this to you. So right after these words from our sponsors, we're going to start on this wonderful video audio from the Words of Peace.
You are listening to your daily dose of well-being and inspiration on Law of Attraction Radio Network at LOARadionetwork.com. Hear this incredible show on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, which goes through your car stereos with Ford Sync or any auto dashboard that has the internet. Listen to our 24/7 broadcast with our mobile app as well, or just listen through an MP3 player or computer. Remember, LOARadionetwork.com, heard in over 120 countries, is the radio station for your well-being.
Have you been receiving your free issue of Alms Times magazine in your email box? Every 2 weeks you'll receive this top quality magazine that has spiritual, metaphysical, and scientific information that will rock your world. Go to almstimes.com, OMTIMES.com, to sign up for your free subscription today.
I do not come here to try to explain to you the concept of happiness. Nobody can explain to you the concept of happiness. You know what happiness is. Happiness isn't just simply smiling. You know, happiness isn't simply laughing. Happiness isn't simply a time of day when you become happy. Happiness is happiness because you feel good. Not about something. But see, this is what we think happiness is. Happiness is feeling happy about something. Our child passes college, I am so happy. We win a lottery ticket, I am so happy. We get a promotion, I am so happy. Because we think our happiness is associated with all the things in this world. Somehow, this world is going to make us happy. And I say to you that there is only one person in this world who can make you happy. And you know who that is? Ah. It happens to be this person that you know very little about. Strange. This person that can make you happy, really happy. You don't really know much about them. You know about your friends. You know a lot about them. Other people, the other associates, the business, the colleagues. But very little about yourself. Who are you? Because you are that person who can make you very happy. Who are you? You came. You are given this gift of breath. You don't think much about it. You will. But it'll be at the end. When it's getting hard. Then. Breath. 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 Life is important. Yeah. Life is important. I mean, I see on the highways people driving. Honking horn, going around, yelling, screaming. Somehow I get the feeling that these people don't really think life is important. They just want to get where they're going. That's what's important. I want you to take a minute. I want you to take a little time. And I want you to understand something. That your life is incredibly important. You're not a number. You're not a name. You are more than the sum of all your goods and all your bads. You are more. What is yours? Do you know? You. This life pounding into you, this breath pounding into you, where does it come from? where does it go? And every time that it comes, it brings the gift of life. And what, my friend, is life? When you are conscious, this life holds promises after promises after promises after promises after promises after promises for you. Gifts after gifts after gifts after gifts after gifts. Which gift have you accepted? If you are a stranger to your own self, then you came. You lived a while. And like many, ended up leaving. Came, lived a while, and gone. It will happen. Three things, three facts. You were born. This is a fact. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. Second, you're alive. Third, you've got to go. Birth. This is what I say, and this is how I look at it. Birth has happened. When I was born, I don't really remember. Obviously I was born, but I don't remember being born. And the last one, going, it's going to happen. I don't even have to make an appointment. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. I have no control over it. But between the birth and the going, I can do something. And of all the things that I can accomplish, let it be that I am fulfilled, that I know myself. That of all the people I have tried to understand, that I understand myself. Because this is a desert. And I want the rain of peace and I want the rain of understanding to come.
Now, wasn't that wonderful? For more inspiration, go visit Words of Peace Global, the website where you can see all of these things. You can send people emails of the videos that they can experience the inspiration. If this goes global, we'll be able to really start rippling out, and world peace is attainable. So with that, let's bring out Dr. Sereni Pillay. And I want everybody to get really comfortable and just soak in all of this wonderful knowledge, because it's true. We create our environment. It starts with us and it ends with us. And so let it begin now. Welcome back, Dr. Sereni Pillay.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great for me as well. It's always good to talk about this stuff, because I feel like the more we can get the word out there and the more we can support each other, the easier it will be for us to be happier, not just as individuals, but as a community as well.
And that's so important, because today is September 11th, 2011. So we are remembering that horrific day. So what does that day tell us about the law of attraction? Tell us, what's your opinion about 9/11, and how do we create from here a peaceful world?
I think, like everyone, I think 9/11 was a horrible event. I think it was an act of terrorism, and I think it was a tragedy. And it was a tragedy for the people who had died and also for the people who were connected then, who continued to be alive. So I think from the point of view of the law of attraction, I think, you know, when I think about that, it's difficult to comment on, you know, one of the questions that comes up is, did we attract that situation in some way? And I think there would be people who would say, yes, by virtue of how our sensitivities were, we may have attracted a negative sentiment. And I could understand that. But I think the whole idea of attracting terrorism, it's difficult to put all that responsibility on us. And I would be inclined not to do that. Because I think what this exposes to us is that it's not, the law of attraction is not just a one-way thing. Right? It's not just like you sit in one place and then you attract something to you. In the case where there are two nations with people in both places, who's attracting what? You know, because so what I would say is that what that situation was that it attracted awareness to the level of conflict that exists in the different countries. And if I had to look at the positive side of that, which is very hard to do considering how horrible I think that act was, what I would say, though, is that as horrible as that was, we do need to think about what we've learned from it. And I think what we've learned from it are a couple of things. Firstly, you can break our buildings, but you can't necessarily break our spirit. And I think you can take away from that we've increased our level of awareness in the world, and that when you raise your level of awareness, it doesn't necessarily mean that things get better. What it means is that action has to occur. And I think one of my constant points of emphasis that have departed from the traditional notion of the law of attraction is the idea that action has to be an important part of attaining your goals. That even if a situation like that, as I concluded, sort of attracted the notion of raising people's levels of awareness about the conflicts that existed, we still have to act into that, and we have to act into recognizing that way of attracting levels of attention is not productive. You know, all it does is it creates death, it creates sadness, it creates a lot of dissent. And I think that what we need to do is learn from that and say, okay, that's not how we want to attract attention to this. Is there a proactive way that we can say there are differences amongst people? Is there a way that we can live harmoniously together? And living harmoniously doesn't mean you have to agree with everything someone is saying. It means that you have to know how to be respectful on both sides of that equation. And to me, 9/11 was really a massive act of disrespect. And I think it's an unfortunate circumstance that occurred.
And it's unfortunate, but at the same time, wouldn't you say that we have all expanded from the experience? I mean, because now I see more collectively that people are striving for peace, worldwide peace, not just peace in just one country. It's worldwide now. The desire, the passion for that is so intense now.
Yeah, I think two very positive things. One is the resilience that the U.S. has had in the face of that. And the fact that resilience, you know, I think it's important to recognize it's not just sort of, you know, having beefed up security. It really is also about having the resilience to continue living your life, you know, to continue to be flying in planes, to continue to do what you need to do on an everyday basis. So I think one of the positive things about that is certainly the resilience. I think that, but as you point out, I think the idea of seeking peace is really important, you know, and I think that I think there are a lot of people in the world who are dedicated to it. I don't feel like we're that close to achieving it yet. But I think that if we're on a path to being aware about the importance of peace, and if we're on a path of being aware of why we need that in the world, then we're on the right path. You know, there was a philosopher whose name was Krishnamurti, who was, you know, well known throughout the world. And one of the things he pointed out in a discussion was that we're not thoughtful enough about the way we are. And he pointed out two things. He said, if you are nationalistic, then you are insular or tribal. And what he said was, you know, on the one hand, you know, I do feel nationalistic about the U.S. I think there are a lot of things to love about the U.S. But I think what he was pointing out was it's important to love where you're at, but not to the exclusion of other countries, because we really are interdependent. We depend on the economies of other countries. Other countries depend on us. So to simply trap ourselves in a nationalistic sentiment works against us because we're not recognizing the opportunities for growth that exist through interaction. So I think at one level he was pointing that out. At another level, he pointed out something really interesting because he asked the question in his video. He said, why don't you change? And then contemplated and said, we continue to have wars. If you loved your children, you would not have a war. If you really loved your children, fundamentally, you wouldn't create situations where their lives were at risk. So you're not thinking about it that deeply when you're just advocating war. If you've thought about it, and then you say, well, the trade-off is that people are at harm, but I need to represent something, that's one thing. But most people don't even think about it at that level. So I think this kind, the kind of discourse that we're having is the kind of discourse that we need to have in the world, even when we don't see the solution. Like frankly, I have lots of dreams and wishes, but I don't see the immediate solutions because people are so different that I think that there are some people who are enrolled into creating something that will attract goodness all around, and there are other people who are simply not interested in that. And I think the more we can start a conversation, the better off we are. Because one of the things I've always felt about the whole idea of the law of attraction and what it represents is that I think it's best represented not simply as an exclusive community where people talk amongst themselves about how they believe in this. I think it's really well represented if we can say, here we are a body of people who believe that good things can happen and there are ways to achieve them. They're not easy. They don't happen to everybody automatically. But here is what we're going to try to do. We are going to act into the faith about positivity and recognize that that in itself is a growth process. I think that would be great because what we'll be doing is starting a conversation between pro and anti-attraction people. And I think that's where we need to be in the world, where we can be in the same room and have people say, I think that's nonsense. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think people like me, I would definitely want to represent the fact that there are ways in which it makes sense. But I would absolutely respect someone who said, you know, I have a check in my drawer for the last 10 years for $10 million. I've gotten nothing but a lost job. You know, I can imagine someone who says that, I can imagine why they feel that dissent. And what I would say is, well, maybe you took the law of attraction too literally. You know, for some people, the law of attraction works that easily because they've already pruned their consciousness. They've either been meditating for a long enough time, they've learned how to focus on what they want, they have a ton of unconscious processes that take them to their goals, so they're able to get there. Whereas for other people where that focus has not been there, that kind of laser focus that activates, you know, which when you leave that sort of activates the unconscious processes, for some people that doesn't exist. And so the process has got to be different. But the whole point is, let's have a conversation about things we agree and disagree about, rather than be killing people.
Yes, very well said. Let me ask you, you know, with people getting together and not agreeing, can you in fact get to a place? I mean, I'm thinking of Congress right now that you can't get anywhere. How do you do that? How do you attract compromise and working together when both sides are not seen?
It's extremely challenging. I think most people who are in negotiations and have studied negotiations find it extremely challenging. But one very important dimension of this is empathy. And there are actually two kinds of empathy. There's emotional empathy and there's cognitive empathy. Now, emotional empathy is when one person makes sounds to reflect that they understand what the other person is saying. So if someone says, I'm very sad, you might say, oh, no, I'm sorry, I feel I share that, I know what it feels like. So you reflect the other person's emotion. Whereas cognitive empathy is when somebody comes at you and says, well, you know, I don't want to change that budget. What you do is when you have cognitive empathy, you say, well, I don't understand your perspective, but I'd love to understand your perspective.
Ah.
Cognitive empathy, what you're doing is you're putting yourself in the other person's shoes And you're saying, then you reframe it. You say, so from your perspective, you think the budget should not be allocated in this way because of X, Y, or Z. And you say that to reflect that studies have shown that in negotiations, both types of empathy are important, but that cognitive empathy affects the brain in a way that makes it superior. And you're much more likely to reach common ground if you use cognitive empathy as part of your strategy as well. So if you asked me, how is it in Congress that we can reach greater agreement? I think there are a number of ways. I think the first step is to work on empathy authentically, not to simply act like you agree with someone, but to actually see, because, you know, people come from a certain point of view, and they come from that point of view because they feel that they've been influenced in a certain way. So, for example, someone who has worked very hard to build a corporation, who came up from nothing, who tried to build a corporation and then found that they were able to build a corporation up to a point but not beyond that, and then lost money, that person may be opposed to greater taxes for corporations. That person may say, you know, I don't think we should have it, and they may have a powerful rationale behind it. But in fact, the real power behind the rationale may be their own experience. Usually it is people's own experiences that informs their rationale. Now, that doesn't mean you have to agree with it. And that person may fervently disagree with you and say, I don't think there should be more taxes on corporations. I don't think we need to be paying more money. We're trying to create jobs anyway. We can't create more jobs if we don't have money. You know, even if you want to disagree with that, one way you can reach a point of negotiation about that is to say, okay, so rather than my being attacking of your viewpoint, why don't I take a step back and truly try to understand your position? Because I don't think I really get it. Like, I don't really get what's going on in you. Because you're saying to me that you don't want more taxes. Clearly, you've had some experience that we don't understand. And if you can get the person to the place where they're describing experience, you know, this is not, you know, I wasn't born into wealth. This is a rags-to-riches story. I worked hard for my money. I don't trust the government. I don't want to have to give half of my money to the government. When you hear that, you can say, I completely understand where your mistrust comes from. And your mistrust comes from partly what you've seen, but partly what you've not seen. Mm. So let's try to address how we're actually using the money in government, and let's address that concern of yours. Because am I right that if you knew how the money was being used, you would feel better about giving up your money?
Absolutely, yeah.
And then the person would say, yeah, you know, I would. And you'd say, well, okay, in order to address his concern, can we say that we as a group will be absolutely scrupulous about letting people know how we're spending the money so they don't feel like we're putting something under the covers or washing it under the carpet? So in that way, what you've done is you've used cognitive empathy to understand another person's point of view, and then you get them to say to you what's actually concerning them is the fact that they don't know how the money's going to actually be used. Why give up half of their money to taxes if they feel like, you know, the roads are still bad, there aren't more jobs? I mean, you know, all the things that are visible. But there may be another government perspective where the government says, look, we need this extra money if we're going to pay off our debt. And in order for us to create more jobs, we need to pay off the debt. So why don't we give you a more stringent reporting? So rather than reporting to you every X, Y, or Z, would it matter to you if we shifted and we said, let's tell you more often. And in fact, let's make it transparent for the entire American community. How about we create a website where on that website, everyone can see every cent that's being spent?
That would be nice. Why have they not done this already?
But, you know, I think that would solve a lot of problems. And I think once you get into the nitty-gritty of why people are concerned. And, you know, the opposite side is true as well. You know, there's the side of people who are saying, I really think we need to pay taxes and we need to pay more taxes. And other people are saying that that's ridiculous. Like, why do you feel that? You know, people will critique, for example, rich Democrats. And they'll say, you know, you've already got enough money. So that's why you don't care about giving up your money. And so, you know, similarly, a rich Democrat could say, yeah, you're right. I do have enough money, but I'll tell you the thing that really troubles me. I don't understand how we, as such an advanced nation in the world, can have so much poverty.
Mm.
And I would like to understand if we can put a little dent in that, how come we have people who have billions of dollars in this country, and then we have a bunch of people who've got nothing? You know, our poverty level, realistically, is actually at the worst level that it's ever been, historically. So a Democrat could say, maybe you're right, don't pay more taxes. I don't know. What I'm saying is, the only solution I can find is that we at least look at that as a potential solution. Can we be open to that? You know, and maybe we can build in another incentive. If you pay more taxes now and we have a recovery of some kind, maybe later on there can be some kind of benefit to you because you paid taxes when we needed it. Do you know what I mean? Because everyone's demanding from everyone right now. Everyone's like, you've got money, so you give me money.
Yeah.
You know, and so it ends up being pretty ugly. I don't think in any society you can really isolate any one level of person. In the same way that you cannot isolate the poor, you cannot isolate the rich as well. And you cannot isolate the middle class either. It's one community. So there needs to be a discussion, and there needs to be a realistic discussion about that. And I think sometimes what we tend to do is we tend to polarize things. We tend to overattend to the poor, or overattend to the wealthy, or overattend to the middle class, without a sense of authenticity.
Mm.
You know, because sometimes I feel like people speak the middle class speak, you know, they talk, the middle class talk, because they know that's where the votes are going to come from.
Ah, yes, yes. It's not authentic. Yes, I agree. Yeah, you can see that. But let's bring it back to the law of attraction then. We have, our economy is, you know, really in the dumps right now. Okay, law of attraction, knowing all that's going on. What can we tell our brains in order to start creating those jobs, in order to start bringing in that income? Because during a time of depression, there are many, many, many millionaires being made.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I would say is a slight modification of what I've said earlier, because I've talked to a lot of people over time, and, you know, it's different in this time because there's so many stresses. So to tell someone who's jobless, who is not able to support their families, who's losing their house, be positive, you know, they look at you like you're crazy. Sort of like, what are you talking about? How can I be positive when I've lost everything? So all I would say is, can you recognize that negative thinking has distortions associated with it? And let me give you some scientific evidence to show you why. Firstly, when you think negatively, or you're highly anxious or highly stressed, you're overactivating the emotional center of the brain. And when you overactivate the emotional center, it's affecting the way you think because the emotional center and the thinking center are connected. And as a result of that, the way you make decisions, the way you assess risks, all of those things are being impacted negatively in a distorted way. So what I would say is, rather than switching from negativity to optimism, would it be possible for you to switch to a more neutral position, which is relatively positive? It's not absolutely positive, but it's relatively positive. And what it will do is it will get you into a place where you can then invite more possibilities into your life. And inviting it is not just an abstract phenomenon. You know, essentially, you're taking all your attention that's been consumed by anxiety, and you're saying, let me take a step back, and let me ask you, if I take a step back from this, I'm going to have more attention to pay attention to opportunities. I'm not consumed by my worry. The other kind of scientific evidence that I would provide is, you know, a study was done looking at how people respond in uncertain times. And they took two groups of people, a group of people who were uncertain and a group of people who were certain. And they found that in the uncertain group, 75% of the people mispredicted when bad things were going to happen.
Really?
So when you are in an uncertain situation, your brain tends to tell you that bad things are going to happen. Because the brain doesn't like that kind of uncertainty. So it says, okay, be careful, be careful, be careful, be careful. And so it starts to say, you have to watch out. And if you think about the stock market, you think about how we're making predictions every day, we're in a situation of constant uncertainty. So if you have that much uncertainty, what it's going to do is make people think that bad things are going to happen. And so they're going to watch out for bad things, and it's going to drop the value of stocks. So I'm not saying think good things are going to happen. I'm saying, if you know that 75% of people are mispredicting negative events, why not go to a neutral position where you're evaluating the data at hand, not through a negative lens, but through the lens of possibility. You know, we've talked about this at length. You know, I think it's one thing to say bad things are happening and what am I going to do? It's not a great instruction to give the brain. It's a little too removed from positivity, meaning from what you can do. So when you tell the brain bad things are happening, I'm losing my job, I can't keep my house anymore, the brain says, I'm sorry. You know, what else is the brain going to do besides absorb that emotional state? You know, I'm speaking metaphorically there.
Sure.
But if you said to your brain, okay, there's some really bad stuff happening, and I am interested in recovery. I am interested in saying to myself, I've got to rebuild my life, I've got to figure out how to get to where I was at least, and then beyond. Your brain says, oh, great. Well, how do we do this? And you say, well, I'm going to tell you things consciously, but I'm also going to affect my unconscious. I'm also going to find ways to decrease my amygdala activation. I'm going to meditate or be mindful, you know, in a way so that you don't get consumed by your emotions. You actually observe your emotions. And so I think that I can talk about this forever, but in terms of the law of attraction, I think that if bad things are happening in the country and we want better things to happen, I think we need to shift from a negative to a neutral position. We need to say, there is a science behind the law of attraction, and that science tells us that when we are consumed by negativity, it distorts our perception. It's probably true also about being unnecessarily consumed by positivity. You know, because if you say, well, great things are happening, but there's a steamroller coming down the road, you know, it's not going to help you no matter how optimistic you are. So what I would say to people is, it's important to be hopeful strategically. You put the hope where it matters. So where it matters is in your life planning, for example. You know, I wouldn't say feel really positive and walk into a dark alley and put yourself in danger. I wouldn't say there's a hurricane, so enjoy it positively. It might be possible for certain people to do that, but by and large, most people are not equipped to deal with negative events in that way. What I would say is recognize the importance of hope. Recognize how it is strength building. Recognize that by leveraging on your strength, you will be able to do what you want to do. And the simple metaphor I like to use for this is just baking bread. You know, if you wanted bread and you went to every store and you said, there's no bread in every store today, it's so horrible, I can't have bread. That could be one thing. Or you could say, wait a minute, I know how to bake bread. You know, I have flour. You go through the whole procedure of baking bread and you say, if you focus on baking bread, you'll have bread. If you focus on the fact that the bread is not available, you won't have any. And that's what the hope is about. The hope is about where you place your attention.
Very interesting. So that brings to mind, you know, they have, I guess this is where the controversies start up, like even the year 2012 and the end of the world. It's because we're all focusing on the negativity, and the more negativity comes to us, and soon everybody's predicting the end of the world.
Well, it was some, I can't remember exactly who it was. I can't remember if it was Mother Teresa or someone else, but there was someone who said that I never ask for no war. You know, I always ask for peace.
Right.
And the whole idea is not to even mention that word in that phrase, because it activates the brain. Under stress, you may actually have the opposite of what you want. So it's really important to ask for the thing you want. So rather than, you know, no rejection, you ask for acceptance. You know, and you go into the place where you're expecting that. I saw an ad on TV the other day, which was really nice, which was, get ready, something good may happen.
Oh, I love it.
And it was so great, because the whole idea is, when you're ready for good stuff to happen, a lot of times it does happen. People will say, oh, that's a load of nonsense. And I would say, well, how often have you been ready for something good to happen? Truly, deeply ready for something good to happen.
Well, tell me, how do you do it with your brain? How do you tell the brain that... there's ways of speaking to the brain. I am, or I have, or I feel. What do we do?
Well, I think it depends on different situations. So what, the overarching principle that I talk to people about is that when you separate yourself from your desire, you will never be together. You know, I want $1 million means I want to be a millionaire. But how are you going to be a millionaire unless you are one? So let's just think about that together. You have to first become the change you want. I think Gandhi was the person who said that.
Right.
And in order to become the change you want, if you want to be a millionaire or you want to be a billionaire, then you've got to start thinking like a millionaire or a billionaire. A millionaire or a billionaire does not sit around saying, in large part, does not sit around saying, oh, you know, I want $1 million, or I want $10 million, and but the world's in disarray and there's nothing I can do. The millionaire gets up, goes to work, focuses on the possibility of making money. As you pointed out, there are a ton of people who are making money in this economy. Those are the people who are thinking like millionaires. So what I would say about I am and I have is that it's important to become the change you want, because when we think about this from a dualistic philosophy, you know, the whole idea of non-dualism is becoming one with things. So if you want to feel connected to and accepted by people, they need to be part of your mindset, not I am going there. Now, the whole idea of like I desire something, even take something as simple as an apple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you will, as long as you desire the apple, you will be an apple desirer. But if you are someone who has the apple, you will take the money out of your pocket, you will go to the store, and you will buy the apple. Now, if you say, well, what if I don't have money to buy the apple? You would say, well, if you're an apple desirer, you'll always stay in the state of desire. But if you give up that desire as the separating factor between you and what you want, you will say, how can I make money to buy that apple? And in the same way, you know, for a lot of people, I think it's easy to think about how to make 10 cents or how to make a dollar. It's not so easy to think about how to make $100,000 or $500,000 or $1 million. But if you think about it, it's just a matter of scale. It's just a matter of, you know, how do I take what I know and then build it on a larger level? Mm-hmm. And how do I translate this information? And there's a subtlety in here, just in terms of positivity and opportunity. And I'll point this out. You know, I came across somebody recently who was a very successful entrepreneur. She actually built a business that grew close to $100 million and then ended up selling. And she was talking to me recently and she said, you know, my real passion in life was being on stage. Like, I love theater. But then I decided to go into business. And what I realized that in business, you know, I missed being on stage. I missed acting, but I could take those same passions and put them into sales, put them into marketing. Because I had to be in front of a board saying, I want you guys to give us $15 million because we can make that into $30 million. And her whole dramatic passion got channeled into that. So what she did was, she didn't say, I can't believe I'm not an actor. How come I'm not an actor? I mourn that. Let me sit down and say I lost the passion of my life. She said, now that I have that passion, and now that I'm in this world, how can I apply that passion? So she looked for that opportunity, and rather than saying, I want to be an actor, she just said, you know, actually, that's who I am. I am about drama. You know, I'm a dramatic person. It's how I am. And so I'm going to express my passions in that way in the boardroom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what she did. So I think that being the change you want, or becoming that, is really helpful in realigning your mental processes. It basically helps you say to yourself, you know, I really need to act like the person I want to be. You know, if you want a radio show or you want to be in a video, rather than saying, well, I wonder how to do this and stay in the wonder. If you want to be a wanderer, then you can wonder about it. But if you want to do it, you've got to figure out how the Skype works. You have to figure out how to, you know, and when they say if you build it, they will come, that's literally true. You know, if you build a platform for interviewing people, they will be there and you'll be able to talk to them.
Exactly. That's so true. That's how it happens. Where does the subconscious come into this then? Okay, we can feel as if we are millionaires. We can be the change that we want to be. But what about those little things saying, no, you can't? Because in your book, Life Unlocked, you talk about the success and the fear of success. And that has a lot to do with that inner voice that comes out and says, no, you can't.
Yeah, you know, I see this so often in so many different contexts. You know, whenever people tell me, you know, I'm satisfied or content, I'm always a little bit suspicious because I don't know if that's code for I gave up.
Ah.
And whenever someone says that to me, I think, are they really satisfied? Or are they telling me not to interfere with the fact that they've given up? And how do I talk to them about this? Because those little voices can be really powerful. Firstly, they're unconscious, so they're not even aware that someone has told them, something has told them to give up.
Mm-hmm.
They've basically stopped, you know, immediately. And so part of what they're thinking is, you know, when you think about, well, what do you do with this? Firstly, does the unconscious exist definitely? And, you know, we can see this from other things that I've said in the past. It exists, and those voices do exist. And sometimes they need to be allowed to exist. And sometimes, not the negative voices, the voices that put ideas together. So there's something I haven't talked about before, which I'm really sort of excited about right now, which is the default mode network.
Oh.
And this is a group of brain regions which come online when you are doing non-focused tasks. So they're in the memory centers of the brain, they're in other thinking parts of the brain, other mood parts of the brain, other assessment parts of the brain. And when you're in a focused mode, like I've got to get the task done, then your default mode centers are quiet. They're just working in the background. They're doing their work in the background. That's part of what's going on unconsciously. When you are in the mind wandering state, you know, you're taking a shower, you're going for a walk, going to catch tea, you know, whatever it is you're doing. If you're just sort of in a wandering, you don't really have a focused activity. This default state comes back online, and studies are showing that this default network that usually acts in the background, it needs to be given some time of day to be able to do its thing, because it increases introspection, and it also increases the possibility for creativity and innovation.
Really?
And if you look at Herb Benson's relaxation response and how he talks about how people get creative ideas, they get creative ideas first by focusing on the task, and then you super focus, and then you take your mind off it completely and do something completely unrelated, and then you come back to the task. And while you've been doing the unrelated thing, you've been giving the default mode network a chance to make its associations, you know, in a more efficacious way.
Oh, that makes so much sense. That's happened. Yes, yeah.
And so I totally think that we can use these unconscious brains to help us. But if we're obsessed with constantly having focused activity, you know, you were saying everyone's so stressed, so everyone works harder, everyone's doing more. And, you know, if you think about it, there's not that much time. Like everyone, if they're not working, they're focused on the BlackBerry or they're focused on the iPhone, and they're saying, you know, I got to check this up, I got to check my email. Constantly focused activity, you know, all that does is it keeps those creative, innovative centers out of the picture. So if you want to figure out how to address that stress, it's important to do that by activating those default networks, and that's a positive way of engaging those unconscious parts of your brain. What you pointed to initially, which is, aren't there things that pull you in the opposite direction? Absolutely. The fear of success, I think, is, I mean, firstly, there's this whole feeling of being a fool, right? Because in this economy, no one's thinking, boy, it's really easy, this is the way I do it. So it would be like saying, you know, would you like to skate on that ice even though you've not skated before? You know, you would say, you know, no, I don't want to fall. And the whole idea is, well, first you got to get used to falling. But if you are the first person to step on the ice, if there are 10 people who've never skated on ice before, and one person goes onto that ice and starts to learn and falls and learns and falls and learns and falls, they are much more likely to be able to be the first person to know how to skate on the ice as well.
So you're just saying that the failure sometimes is what you need to get you to the place where you're...
That's right. And so I think that rather than fear the failure, recognize that it's a realistic possibility, that most people who've succeeded often have to fail. You know, I did that actually this morning. I was playing tennis with my coach, and And I just decided that my serve was just was too weak and I wanted to strengthen it. And, you know, I had the wrong racket grip. And I kept on, and I served quite well with the wrong racket grip. But with the right racket grip, I served terribly. And so I had to make a decision. Do I want to serve well with the wrong grip or serve badly with the right grip? And I chose to make myself face my inadequacy by serving correctly with the difficult grip, because eventually that grip was gonna serve my game better. And so even though I struggled and struggled and struggled, when we played a little game at the end of that, it ended up being much better because I had taken the time to fail before that. So whenever you fear failure, take the time to fail.
Wow, that's powerful. That's powerful. Now let's talk about your book, Science Beyond Law of Attraction. Let's talk about that because it's a workbook too. And I think that is the ticket to get a lot of people going in the right direction and kind of rewiring the brain. Am I wrong?
No, that was my whole intention in writing that book. My whole intention in writing that book was to get people to recognize that, yes, we all agree that everybody doesn't have equal access to some of these automatic processes. That for some people, simply having that thought because of their own history is able to bring things into their lives. But for other people, you need to work at it. And so this book is essentially about the science behind the law of attraction, how to talk to your brain, how to actually be positive without being a cheerleader, you know, how to embrace change and deal with change, and a whole lot of different facets. It's a short book, and what it actually does is gives people concrete exercises at the end of every section so that they can guide themselves through a specific goal. So, you know, I think you've read it, and we've talked about it in at length, and I think that there have been many people who've used it who've actually said to me that they found it particularly helpful.
Exactly, and now is the time to really be focusing in on this book, because this is actually the perfect tool that everybody, it really needs to be in every home. You know, everybody needs to have this, especially, you know, what if children have this book and started off? Wouldn't that change the world right now?
Absolutely. You know, I think you're picking a really important point, and that's one of the reasons I love the work that you do, Jules. I actually think that it's such an important thing to have someone who's willing to take a step. You know, it's not easy to take a step out at a time like this and say, come on, guys, be positive. There's a positive side to this. You know, because the world is not necessarily more receptive to that. So the fact that you have the courage to do that, and I think it comes from your authentic belief in what it is, I think it says a lot. And I think that focusing on children is a great example. Because, you know, children do have free spirits a lot of the time. They're affected by what goes on in the environment. But if you can, and a child's brain is changing at such a rapid rate, that if you can actually train the brain of a child to go through exercises like that and actually start focusing on what they want, we will be affecting our community from the ground up. We want to rebuild America. One of my greatest passions is actually that. Now, I'm actually writing another book right now and writing a proposal with someone who's from the law of attraction space as well, which we can talk about later. I'm not sure how much I can say about it.
Oh, how exciting.
But it's essentially, you know, it comes from a place of saying, you know, I think that as a metaphor, whether you're a country that's been up or down, a person that's been up or down, if you've been down, you can always get up. And there is a way to do that. And so what the message that I want to share is that I think that people and countries can be as powerful as they want to be through a different set of considerations. I don't think power is about isolation. I think we're recognizing that. I think power is about interdependence and knowing how to dance that dance. Hmm. And that's what we've got to teach ourselves. And what I think the book sets up is a mind state to be able to interact in the world in that way.
Well, maybe we should send your book to every member of Congress.
I would love that.
I would love that, too. I think everybody would love this. And not only that, let's get it into every school so it is taught at an early age. So that, you know what, if we could focus in on this, we may be able to achieve worldwide peace.
I completely agree with that. You know, I think that that's such a great idea to talk about, you know, instilling it in children, just from a biological perspective even. You know, the brains of adults can change, so this book is definitely for adults as well. But I think because children are so amenable to learning and their brains are so active and the neurons are changing their connections all of the time, why not provide this message to children?
So parents and child or children should be doing this together. It shouldn't just be the parents. This is a great learning opportunity for both of them together.
Well, what a wonderful way to bond as a family.
Yeah.
To say, let's all get together. You know, it reminds me a little bit. It's a healing method. Right? You know, there was a thing that used to be called Friar's Balsam. It was sort of essentially an inhaling technique. If your nose is clogged, to basically put a blanket over your head and then heat up the solution, and then you inhale these vapors that clear up your nose, and the whole family gets under the blanket at the same time. It's the same thing about positivity. Why not get everybody together at the same time, start off a mealtime, saying, what's our affirmation for today? You know, what's our positive truth about today? What are we going to be saying that is going to change our lives? And what are we going to be believing? And you see this all the time. You know, I've seen some children who don't want to play a sport, even though they're good at it, because they're afraid of being ridiculed.
Mm-hmm.
Or you see children who are afraid to go to school because they're bullies. You see children who think they're not as great as they want to be at school. You know, all of this stuff really affects you. You know, studies have actually shown, for example, in girls, if they're primed before a mathematics test to be told how good they are at mathematics, simply that. Not taught more, not so they do better at those tests.
Wow.
So it's a pretty powerful message. You know, the fact that if we can prime children to know that they can expect more of themselves, the brain will reach out toward that possibility. And so I think it's a great idea to include children in this. It's a great idea to include parents in this, in a dialogue with their children about
this. Yes. Absolutely. Matter of fact, I'm going to go out and get this workbook so that my grandson and I can work on it together. I think that's really important. And I'll be able to see it in action. It's just wonderful. How exciting. And you're right. It is the perfect way to bond. So tell everyone how we can get this tremendous workbook.
Thank you. Well, so the workbook, The Science Behind the Law of Attraction, is available on Amazon, and you just have to check in Amazon and then punch in The Science Behind the Law of Attraction, and you'll see that. And there are similar principles in Life Unlocked, which I also wrote last year.
Yes.
And then I also wrote Your Brain in Business, which is for business people. So, you know, there are different contexts in which you can apply these principles in different ways. And I've always said to myself, if a book can change just one thing in your life, then I will be pleased, because I think change is so challenging for all of us. And at a time like this, if you can just get some breath of fresh air, you know, not just let's feel inspired and let's feel great, but you know why this works and then what to do to put it into practice, I think that would make a huge difference for all of us.
I agree. Dr. Pillay, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on my show. You are just such a breath of fresh air. I just appreciate everything you've done for the world.
Thank you so much, Jules, and I appreciate you similarly. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And to all my wonderful listeners, we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye. As we close another show, it is my sincerest wish that you have a wonderful week ahead. Remember, through you, the world changes to reflect your happiness. If you'd like to comment on today's show, please send me an email to jules@loaradionetwork.com.